This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country. We're online and through the Share Radio mobile app every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, to talk through some of the stories on their site they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, could Brexit lead to recession? The Bank of England suggests it could, costing jobs, raising prices, seeing the pound fall sharply, but it's caused something of a political row.
It is our responsibility to analyse those risks, to consider how and if we should mitigate those risks. We have to communicate those.
Well, I think the governor ought to be very careful with what he says. This is the third dire warning. They become ever more dire each time he speaks.
Also today, we focus on the troubles of youth. Inflation, as measured by the Consumer Prices Index, is 0.5, right? Or is it? Not for millennials, we're hearing. Welcome to Generation Inflation.
If I'd known all of this kind of 3 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done a degree.
So, are things really worse for our young people than previous generations? We explore whether a good job, a nice home, and an early, comfortable retirement are based on fragile foundations. Is this the end of the middle-class dream? Also, is this the end of the Challenger Bank dream? A new chart reveals how they're luring in savers with Best Buy deals only to rein them in once they're established.
They come because of service. They become because of a new approach to banking. They come because they're just fed up with their old bank.
Simon blogs again for his Minor Investor. This time he looks at advice on how to build a buy and hold dividend portfolio. And Mustang Sally. Can an American muscle car be the best value sports car this year? But before we get to all of that, we are asking today, quite simply, Simon, how does it feel to be a winner? Simon Lambert, editor of the financial website of the year.
Thank you very much, Georgie.
Yes,
it feels good. You should know what it feels like to be a winner, Georgie, because I think that you are the financial broadcaster of the year, were you not? This was at the Headline Money Awards on Tuesday night, which is one of the big financial media awards. And This Is Money was lucky enough to pick up financial website of the year. And the person sitting opposite me in this studio was named the financial broadcaster of the year, beating many other people from places like the BBC. So congratulations, Georgie.
Thank you very much. Also commendation, I should say, for savvy woman Sarah Pennells, who's also on Share Radio, and the brilliant Ed Bowsher, often a contributor on This Is Money, this podcast as well, also did incredibly well. But it was a successful round for you, wasn't it, Simon?
It's great. So it's really nice to win awards like this because it's always nice to get the recognition that it brings. And I'm very, very proud of my team because they do an awful lot of hard work to try and help our readers, to fight their corners, to explain what the financial news means to them. And the other person sitting in the studio with me here, Rachel Rickard-Strauss, was highly commended in one of the awards as well.
Congratulations.
So she deserves
Rachel.
Congratulations too.
And a good point you make there, Simon. Congratulations, Rachel. Welcome to the studio. That it is for the listeners, it is for the readers that we do this.
Yeah, it is. It is. We don't just do it for our own benefit. To be honest, if nobody was reading it and nobody was listening, it might be a bit pointless if we were doing it.
That's the spirit there, Simon. That's the spirit. Thank you very much, winner. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. Congratulations.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website, back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up. Joined today by editor Simon Lambert, personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website of the year in partnership with NS&I. And coming up, the troubles of youth, unnecessary cross-selling, dodgy dealings and Mustangs. But first, the Bank of England has ruffled a few political feathers this week. Speaking after the launch of its latest inflation report, the Governor, Mark Carney, warned a vote for Brexit could cost jobs, raise prices, see the pound fall sharply, and even lead to recession.
In the first quarter of this year, growth slowed further to around 1.5 percentage points annualised, and it now appears to be decelerating again. The most recent weakness reflects in part the forthcoming referendum on the UK's membership of the European Union, which has pushed up uncertainty measures to levels not seen since the euro crisis. The referendum makes describing the outlook for inflation more challenging than usual. That's because some asset prices used to condition the committee's projections are likely to have been affected by market participants' perceptions of its consequences. The MPC estimates that referendum effects could account for around half of the 9% fall in the sterling exchange rate since its November 2015 peak, and we've decided not to let that part of the exchange rate's fall feed through to our growth and inflation projections.
So, a technical recession, sharp depreciation in the value of the pound, prolonged uncertainty, higher inflation, and reduced real incomes. Despite saying this was a possibility rather than a forecast, it sparked accusations of bias. Now, MP Jacob Rees-Mogg says the governor's made himself a political partisan and should be fired. Here the pair were sparring back in March.
Our comments, our analysis, does not provide a comprehensive assessment of the economic case for or against any for the status quo or for a change to the status quo with respect to the European Union. We will not be making, and nothing we say should be interpreted as, making any recommendation with respect to that decision.
The Prime Minister told the Sunday Post that he was, quote, sure that the governor, quote, will have something important to say. How could the Prime Minister be sure?
That's a question for the Prime Minister. I have no idea.
So you think the Prime Minister is speculating about what the governor of the Bank of England was going to say?
I have conversations on occasion with the Prime Minister. Those conversations tend to be about the most important economic issues facing the country and the global economy.
So you're not denying that you've had conversations with the Prime Minister about what you might say in relation to the European Union?
I have not had conversations with the Prime Minister about what I might say about the European Union. I had conversations with the Prime Minister and conversations with the Chancellor entirely consistent with what we have put in the public domain in terms of our concerns about the future evolution of the European Union.
This is what I think is doing your reputation and the reputation of the Bank of England harm. That you are coming out with the standard statements of the pro-EU group. It is speculative and beneath the dignity of the Bank of England to be making speculative pro-EU comments.
I'm not going to let that stand.
But bias or not aside, are all these warnings creating a self-fulfilling prophecy and materially damaging the economy in and of themselves? Well, Lord Lamont, a former Chancellor and Vote Leave campaigner, certainly thinks so, calling Mr Carney's intervention inappropriate.
Well, I think the governor ought to be very careful with what he says. This is the third dire warning. They become ever more dire each time he speaks. I think he ought to be very careful. I wondered whether he was trying to calm the markets or whether he was addressing voters. It seemed so extreme what he said. But I think he ought to be careful just in case his prophecies became self-fulfilling. And if in the remote chance there were any crisis, that would be something for which he was responsibility, having created the expectation, the inevitability, as he predicts it, of some sort of crisis. There's no need for any crisis. Britain can trade internationally, carry on trading, as it has done in the past and as many independent countries do. I'm suggesting if he goes on and on saying this, he's in danger of making people believe something that has absolutely no reason for it to happen. The pound has been well below the current levels during the lifetime of this and the past government. It was well below 140 to the dollar at one point. People were predicting a few weeks ago, with all their dire warnings, that it would go below 140, and of course it hasn't. It's bounced up back again. And if you look at the government bond market, the gilt market, there's hardly a ripple there. Foreigners are buying government securities as they always have, without any sign of any pause. No rise in rates in that market. Quite calm psychology.
Well, that was Lord Lamont there. Well, now the International Monetary Fund, which promotes global financial stability, has also issued a warning against leaving the EU, saying there could be sizable long-term losses to the UK. The Chancellor, George Osborne, shared a stage with its head, Christine Lagarde, but she insists their analysis is not political and the Treasury hasn't been involved in their work.
We are not doing it out of politics. This is not the job of the IMF. We're doing it because it's a significant downside risk, number one. And second, it's not just a domestic issue, but it's an international issue.
Put simply, the IMF says a vote to leave costs us money. We'd have less to spend on public services like schools and the NHS if we leave the EU.
So, Simon, lots to take in there. But first, to be clear, the Bank of England is meant to be politically neutral. So is this bias or is it just being prepared?
I actually am going to fall on the side of it's the just being prepared thing. OK, I think that this is fair enough. I think that it would be absolutely ludicrous if we had a situation where in just over a month's time we could vote ourselves out of the EU and the Bank of England was basically not saying anything about it whatsoever, just pretending that it wasn't happening. I think that that would be crazy. I think that if you look at what the Bank of England is meant to do, and it, actually if you look at the Bank of England's website, as I am doing now, it says at the top, promoting the good of the people of the United Kingdom by maintaining monetary and financial stability. Now, I don't think that even those people campaigning for Brexit could not argue that probably the more certain side of monetary and financial stability in the short term lies on just continuing with the status quo. A step into the unknown definitely involves probably less of that monetary and financial stability. Whether that step into the unknown is the right move or the wrong move is a completely different matter. But I do think that the Bank of England has an interest in this. I do think that the Bank of England is right to say something. And, you know, I don't think that it will necessarily sway it either. I personally sit on the fence on this issue, and I think that both sides of the campaign have a lot to answer for. But I've just tweeted the latest cover of Private Eye, which I absolutely love because it basically has the headline, Project Fear, Brexit goes nuclear. And it's got Cameron saying, there could be a world war. And Osborne saying, or even worse, house prices might fall. Which is absolutely brilliant. That's a classic Private Eye cover. And to me, that sums up the entire thing. I don't think people are going to vote on this or be swayed, really, by a lot of this economic bickering that's going on. Maybe. I think they're going to vote on this because they do or they don't like the EU.
Maybe, maybe not. A couple that I'll add to that in as much as yes, to be prepared. But one, the timing. It's 6 weeks away. Was it necessary? Also, we're seeing the pound bounce up and down and around due to pronouncements like this. Is it creating a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy and having some material impact on the economy? And has the governor of the Bank of England drawn up what would happen in Remain? Is Remain the silver bullet to kickstart the economy? Everything can be blamed on Brexit debate at the moment?
Well, I suppose we could have an outline of the downsides of Remain, couldn't we? Maybe. Say, like, you know, in 5 years' time, if we do Remain, this might be worse, that
might
be worse.
Has he done that, though? Has the Bank of England done that?
Well, no, they haven't. But I think, you know, genuinely, I don't think that they've stepped out of line by doing this. So,
Rachel?
They do consistently talk about global risks in their inflation reports and financial stability report. They talk about what's going on in Europe and what kind of impact that could have on us, what's going on in China. So they do talk about, I suppose, Europe from that perspective. But what I find so frustrating about this argument is that we've spent 8 years now saying, why did no one see the crash coming? Why did no one say anything? Where were the central bankers? And now central bankers are being told to shut up when they see, you know, what arguably they're suggesting is this, you know, real issue
but
at the end of the road.
But didn't they know things were going wrong then? There was a pattern of behaviour which was creating something which was going to explode at some stage. We just don't know. Mark Carney himself said this is a possibility, not a forecast.
Well, and therefore it's right that he sort of speculates. I mean, that is also this argument from Jacob Rees-Mogg that it's beneath the Bank of England to speculate. That is precisely what economists do. That's all they can do, and that's all you can do when you're trying to forecast what's going to happen to an economy. No one has a clue, particularly not at the moment with sort of with the uncertainty that Brexit creates, but also with the underlying issues that we have and the inflation report talked about that a lot as well, that there are things, all sorts of things going on that even if we took Brexit out of the equation, it would be very hard to forecast growth at the moment and to know what is really going to go to happen.
But if you don't have a clue, why say it? What's the old adage of you put 9 economists in the room and they'll come up with 10 solutions?
Well, I suppose the question here actually surrounds, is Mark Carney entitled to an opinion and to express his opinion? I think he is entitled to an opinion, and I think he is entitled to express his opinion. And I think that one of the things that's been done right around this whole Brexit debate is, you know, by Cameron, by Corbyn, by the other politicians of saying, we're not going to tell you to toe some kind of party line. If you think we should leave, you think we should leave. If you think we should remain, you think we should remain. We'll campaign for each side. And we're going to say now that there'll be no bad blood afterwards. Now, whether there will be bad blood afterwards is another matter. So, you know, does Carney have an opinion? Yes. So then the question is, has he been unduly swayed towards having a certain opinion, the Remain opinion? Well, I don't think so. Do we think that Carney actually thinks that we should leave and that actually he's come out and said Remain and put the weight of it behind it? Come on, the guy's, you know, one of the global central banking elite. He lives for globalization and committees and, you know, technocracies and things like that. You know, he's not going to be the kind of person who thinks that we should ditch the EU, is he? Of course, this is his honest opinion. It'd be mad to think otherwise. Look at the position he's in and look at where he comes from and look at where he moves in the global elite.
I do have to ask, though, his warning about inflation, interest rates may rise, house prices may fall, is that such a bad thing?
Well, that's a good question, and arguably a lot of these things are going to happen further down the line anyway. I suppose it's the kind of lack of control around how those things would happen and the sort of difficult bind that that would put the Bank of England into, whether if inflation starts to rise and it will want to move interest rates, but then we're all in debt. There's a lot more, it just has a lot less control over the situation when we're in this, what will probably be an episode of uncertainty and a lot of fluctuation. But also just, it's not a political issue, I think, for most people. For most people, it's about the material differences that they would see in their lives also arguably quite an emotional decision about how they see themselves in Britain and in Europe. It's not about whether you prefer Michael Gove or you prefer Mark Carney or Jacob Rees-Mogg or whoever it is. It's about people and their lives, and to a certain extent that will come down to money and the economy and the jobs that they have, the mortgages that they have access to, I suppose the houses that they're able to afford, and all of those things are affected by the economy, which is precisely what we have Mark Carney there to talk to us about.
And a lot of people will argue the status quo for them at the moment is not good enough.
If you want to put the arguments for the leave side, I suppose, of, you know, people saying, oh, well, house prices might fall, we might get inflation, there might be all these problems if we leave. It's like, well, on the Remain side, basically, we're in the EU at the moment. We've got low inflation bordering on deflation that economists are worried about. We've got interest rates stuck at 0.5% for the last 7 years. We've got house prices that are way too high. We've definitely got a geographically dysfunctional economy. Mm. So we've got all kinds of problems at the moment. So we could worry about all the problems that we might have if we make a decision in one certain way, or we could also worry about the problems that we have with the status quo anyway.
Well, the reason I ask that as well is you have a poll on your website. Would Britain be better off in or out of the EU, and your readership?
So,
a lot of votes here.
We have looked at the result of this poll before, and the mood of our readers has not shifted.
No.
Would Britain be better off in or out of the EU? 21% think we're better off in, 79% think we're better off out. And that is currently running at about 54,000 votes in total.
That is a lot of votes, which is interesting. And very quickly on this, we heard from the CBI earlier in the week, didn't we, that the gap between businesses wanting to leave or to stay is narrowing, but not so on your website for the general population.
No, and I think it reflects the views. Okay, it obviously reflects the views of our readers, people voting in the poll. And actually, these polls are set up so you can't just sit there and repeatedly hit the same button, you know. But I think this is possibly a little bit more representative of the mood of the general population than a lot of the official polls that come out suggest. And I think that there is a relatively equal chance that we might vote ourselves out of the EU as that we will vote ourselves to remain.
Here at Share Radio, we have been debating the Brexit referendum, bringing you the latest views from the world of business, finance and politics.
You'll find people who want to leave who say, I don't know anyone who wants to stay. And you'll find people who want to stay who say, I don't know anyone who wants to leave. So how it feels to you is imperfect.
We've curated all our Brexit interviews and put them in one place
to help you make an informed decision on the 23rd of June.
Just go to audioboom.com
and type in Brexit special on Share Radio. Yes, do indeed. So no excuses there. A very warm welcome. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Now, we've been speaking about inflation, haven't we? As measured by the Consumer Prices Index, it's 0.5%. Or is it? Not for millennials, apparently. It's at 0.9%. Spending on rent, education, smartphones and meals out mean inflation is running three times as high for the under 30s than pensioners. They're suffering the most from rising prices than any other generation. But it's OK, they're just spending it on going out, right? And enjoying themselves. Well, wrong again. The biggest weekly spend is housing and utilities. A quarter of the average weekly spend compared to 12% for baby boomers. Education also much pricier, spending less on booze and cigarettes. Welcome to Generation Inflation.
I don't feel like anything I could do would be good enough. I mean, if I'd known all of this kind of 3 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done a degree.
A young person can never do enough to get a paid job, because it's always that you can't just go to uni, you have to go to uni and do an internship. You can't just go to uni and do an internship, you have to start your own project.
There are so many people with a degree, that's then the baseline.
At the same time, maybe try and keep down a part-time job and pay all your bills and try and deal with the idea of a 30 grand debt.
Fit an internship around that, plus unpaid stuff. It's not always possible.
So Generation Inflation. Tell us a little bit more about Laura Wickham's excellent piece on This Is Money, Rachel. Firstly, how's it measured, this 0.9 compared to 0.5%, what we thought it was, inflation?
So this is something that Laura's done with help from Fidelity. They crunched the numbers for us. And there are different costings that will factor into sort of our weekly budgeting. And they'll each have their own rate at which those costs are rising or falling. And so that's what's been looked at. And the types of things that millennials are more likely to spend money on are those that are rising in price more quickly. We've seen very low or stagnant inflation for quite some time now, sort of if you look at the country as a whole. But that is due in large part to a few main things: the cost of fuel, the oil price is so low at the moment and has been for the past year or so. So that means that costs at the pumps are much lower. Also, energy bills are down a little bit as well. Food, grocery shopping is much cheaper as well. But those are things that are more likely to make up a higher proportion of your outgoings if you're a little bit older. Whereas younger people are spending more on education and the price of that is going up. Price of going out, also higher. Phone bills, higher as well. And so Fidelity has looked at this across, comparing different age groups. But really, you could break it down any way you wanted. And in theory, you could come up with your own personal inflation rate if you so wished. But I think the reason why they've done it with age is because that's one sort of category that sees the most differences between spending patterns.
You said you can make up your own figure for yourself if you like. So what does this tell us then, a wider picture? Can we take more from this? Is there a generational divide that's happening?
Well, I suppose there's two issues when you're thinking about your spending power. One is how much stuff costs that you want to buy. And the other thing is how much are you earning? If your wages are going up at a higher pace than your personal inflation rate, then actually you're going to be all right. And if it's the other way around, then you'll find that your money doesn't go quite so far. So if we look at the wages of younger people, they're still, I suppose, still pretty low and struggling. You'll see younger people with less to spend. Plus, you have all these awful underlying things in terms of rising house prices, because you can't get on the housing ladder, increasing and extortionate rental prices in some places. Student debt, which is like nothing that's ever been seen before in any other generation. I mean, and if you put it in that kind of context, the difference between, a 0.5% or a 0.9% inflation rate, I mean, that's really the least of your worries when you're struggling against all those other odds.
I mean, you mentioned there trouble getting on the housing ladder, low wage growth, more spent on education than ever in history. I'm wondering what, Simon, this will mean for this generation, but also for future ones. I mean, it leaves so little left to save for their future, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I think if you were to show me the person, the millennial who believes that the cost of what they have to spend on is only going up by 0.9% a year, it would take a long time to find them. I think they'd probably put a much higher number on that. I think one of the things to bear in mind about this is it's a bit of an imperfect definition, when you look at these things. It's because nobody can even decide what a millennial is. So, you know, there are varying
good point.
Degrees.
What's a millennial?
A millennial is, right, so a millennial is generally taken as to be someone who came into about young adulthood around the year 2000. So actually, normally it stretches up to about 35. We're talking specifically about under 30s here. So, you know, often people who were born in 1980 would be referred to as a millennial, but then also people who were 22 and coming out of university are going to be referred to as a millennial. Mm. So I'm probably not a millennial because I'm 37. My sister, who's 35, she was born in 1980. She might be a millennial, but she's got two kids. And whereas someone coming out of university at the age of 22 has got a very different financial situation to my sister. And I think, but also it's kind of about like the personal scenario, because friends of mine, for example, who are professionals but who aren't on the housing ladder, their finances are going to be in a much worse position than someone who was, for example, in their late 20s but had got onto the housing ladder, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So it's really very much about like your own personal circumstances when you look at this. And I think that, yeah, to reflect on what you said, that does have a serious impact on people's ability to save and put money aside for the future. Because you might have the situation where you've got someone who owns their own home and is in their late 20s and can start cracking on with saving for a pension. Or you might have the scenario where you've got someone who's in their late 30s and doesn't own their own home, feels that they're going to miss that boat, and basically doesn't feel that they can put a penny aside for their pension. And that's going to be quite damaging in 30 years' time.
You said it's individual, but then I'm looking here at another article on your website. Are things really worse for our young people? Now, we've grown up in the post-World War II era, thinking every generation, haven't we, better off than the last. But have we reached peak prosperity? Now, this article by an economist on your website, Satyajit Das, seems to suggest as much. The elements of the good life, he says, a good job, a nice home, an early comfortable retirement, the basis of which is, of course, continuous strong economic growth, were based, he says, on fragile foundations and blamed a slowdown of growth.
If you look at the growth in debt since about, particularly the 1990s to, say, 2008, only 15% of it was actually used to buy productive plant equipment and so forth, which actually generates real returns. 85% was essentially to buy existing assets, which is me selling you my house for a higher price and then you selling it to somebody else for a higher price, and also for consumption. Now, obviously, consumption by definition doesn't generate income down the track to pay back the debt. And so we got hooked on this heroin of debt. And the interesting thing about that is in the 1950s, you needed only $1 to $2 of debt to create $1 of GDP. By 2007, 2008, we needed $4 to $5 of debt to create $1 of GDP. Now, to give you some perspective on that, in China, which has been a major contributor to global growth in the last 10 or 15 years, you today need between $6 and $8 of debt to create $1 of GDP. So effectively what happened was during this period of history, debt had to grow at roughly double initially the rate of growth in the real economy. Now, it's like a ratchet system. So to keep the growth going, we just got to keep borrowing at ever-increasing rates. And really what 2007, 2008, the global financial crisis was the warning that this model of a modern economy is absolutely not sustainable.
So that was economist Satyajit Das there speaking before, but he has written for This Is Money. Is he right, Simon? What's he suggesting here?
What he's suggesting is that basically we're getting a bit of a duff deal nowadays compared to the deal that was previously on offer to people, mm-hmm. whereby you had a great deal of job security, employers that took some form of duty of care very seriously, where they would provide for you, they would provide you with more job security, You had a contract, you were contracted to work a certain amount of hours a week, you were more likely to do them. They would give you a pension in retirement and they would take the responsibility for giving you that. That you were able to buy a house because house prices were lower in comparison to wages. That you could go to university and the government would pay for that because it believed that education was a social good. And all other kinds of things like that. Mm. And we know that in the modern world, we don't get those things. Now, the modern world has sold this to us as flexibility. And flexibility is good for you. You're part of the gig economy. You can do anything you want. Unfortunately, that comes with serious impacts for people in terms of the stability that they have in their lives. And what we've seen as the ordinary working man or working woman has got a progressively worse deal is that the super ordinary working man or working woman right at the top has got an increasingly good deal. And the world's super rich, who sit above the super ordinary working man and working woman, are getting an incredibly good deal and swanking around the place in their fancy cars and their yachts and their multi-million pound flats. And understandably, the peasants are revolting and getting a bit angry about this. And what he's suggesting is that we probably need to have a proper discussion about this and think about how we're going to make some form of readjustment, because if we keep going on the course that we're going on, it's probably not going to turn out too well.
You said, Simon, it's getting progressively worse. Was there a point in which, and I'm thinking here, perhaps 2008, where this started to decline? I mean, for example, home ownership was growing up until that point. Ultra-low interest rates, QE, the things that the banks have been doing to try and sort out the mess have actually had the opposite effect.
I think they've made things worse. Mm. I don't think that you can trace this back to 2008. I think you can trace this back much further than that. I think you trace this back to you could probably trace it all the way back to maybe the 80s, the late 70s and the 80s, but then that could have corrected itself and that didn't correct itself. And so we went on this trajectory through the 90s and the 2000s when you started to get all of this stuff whittled down. And there were various factors that came into play. You know, defined benefit pensions were completely undermined by the fact that companies thought the stock market would keep going up by 10% a year, and then they blew all their surpluses after they'd been told to by the government at the time, and then so on and so on and so on. But I think that there is definitely a scenario where we're getting this sort of wedge that's getting wider and wider and wider, and we probably need to take a very good look at it.
You say take a very good look, you say to have a chat about it, but we need to do something. But what can you do about it to stop this trajectory? Any handbrake we can apply?
It's really difficult. It takes a lot of kind of looking into the future, particularly younger generations. You know, they'll put up with it for now, but they don't realise that they're going to end up with much smaller pensions than their parents have, a completely different quality of life. And who knows, by the time that happens, maybe it will be too late to have those discussions. But also, just to make a case the other way round, it's true that we've lost the stability of home ownership and of jobs for life, but a nimbleness in the workforce also does have positives. We're having problems with pension deficits, but that's because we're living so much longer than ever before, and we just have access to things like, I was thinking about flights actually. It's terrible for the environment, and that will be the next generation that pays for it, but for us lot, you can get anywhere for next to nothing. And that kind of mobility that offers, you know, the average family will go to Spain for their holidays because they're able to, although not in half term. That, you know, that also comes with its benefits.
It's impossible to predict, isn't it? Especially with the rise of technology. I mean, we're hearing just this morning new research showing that online and mobile banking is encouraging more 18 to 24-year-olds to save. But I'm wondering what this impact has, not just on the youth, as it were, but also on, we spoke, haven't we, previously, the bank of mum and dad. We're hearing lenders like Halifax Nationwide extending the age of mortgage borrowers.
Well, a lot of it will involve spending almost made-up money that they have, that generation has wealth in their properties that they can afford to fall back on if necessary. The levels of equity release are going through the roof at the moment because people are realising that they have that asset. Also, this is kind of the last generation that does have fairly nice defined benefit pensions, so they are able to help the younger generation with that as well. But also, I think there's another factor that and maybe you'll think me doom-mongering, but sort of looking at what will happen over the longer term in terms of this generation and the one after. As you say, banks closing, people moving towards online banking, the whole workforce is completely going to go through this incredible upheaval that I think that we're not quite thinking about in the way that we need to yet in terms of the jobs that we will have and how we're able to adapt, make sure that we have a workforce that is prepared for these incredible changes that are about to take place. And that more than as much as anything else, I think, will affect job security, certainly job for life. I don't know when things are moving so quickly, whether that's something that we could ever hope for again.
A little bit gloomy.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine. We started off with Mark Carney, so it's fine. We'll just continue that way. Simon, you're lightening the mood for us?
Yeah. I think that we probably will see some turmoil due to the inequality that we're seeing at the moment. I think we already are. But you know what? People are adaptable. People are wonderfully adaptable. Mm-hmm. People come up with amazing ideas. If you look at the progress that, you know, man and womankind has made over the years, it's absolutely astonishing the things that we've come up with. We were talking about things that just seem like magic on the way over here. And I was tracing that all the way back to the fact that I still look at a record and think, how on earth did we ever turn some grooves in a piece of plastic into the sound of an entire band? That is amazing. That is the one thing that sums up how incredibly adaptable people are, and I'm sure that we'll be absolutely fine.
So if you are a youth struggling at the moment, just remember that. Thank you very much, Simon.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
And take a deep breath, Simon. If savings rates aren't tempting you at the moment, time to think about investing. Simon's got his pen out or his laptop. You've been updating your minor investor blog and have some advice on how to build a buy and hold dividend portfolio in the shares that made the cut. Simon, you have 2 minutes. The floor is yours.
OK, so I think that if you look at many investors' portfolios, you'll probably find that they look a bit haphazard. There's some shares that they bought over here, some shares they bought over there, maybe this fund and that fund. And there's no real plan. There's no real what am I doing here kind of thing going on. And we have lots of people who say they'd like to invest, but they just don't know what investments to choose. So I asked our friends at Stockopedia, could they explain to us how you would build your own buy and hold share portfolio where you were targeting dividends, because dividend reinvestment is the thing that really delivers investment returns over time. It's been shown by many studies to do that. And this was because basically I've had the chance to talk to and listen to lots of fund managers over the years. Some of them I probably wouldn't consider worth paying the money, but the ones I do consider worth paying the money tend to be able to explain clearly and simply what their strategy is. They have a plan and they stick to it. So Thomas Firth at Stockopedia came up with a screen for us, which he ran through. And what he was looking for was basically shares that fitted certain criteria. And the idea was that basically they would look for established and stable companies. So they were large, with a market cap larger than 500 million. A long track record of growing free cash flow, because cash is the thing that really matters to a business. Profitability, reliable dividend growth, and a decent yield, and not too much debt. They also needed to not be too expensive, so a price-to-earnings ratio of less than 20. That delivered up a list of 23 names, which would then give you the starting point for building a portfolio. It's not the answer, but you'd need to look into these, do your own research, maybe chuck some out because you don't like them, you don't think they're very good, they might not fit with you ethically, you might not like their business model, you might want to expand the criteria slightly, perhaps to get some other companies in there, maybe some larger companies, some that don't grow as much. But it gives you a good starting point. And what this is an explanation of how you might go about building a portfolio. And I think that Tom at Stockpedia did an absolutely great job in building this for us. So I've used a lot of the stuff that he did for my column, and you can go and read it at thisismoney.co.uk/DIY investing.
Can I just say, Simon, I read this article and thought, that is why you are Financial Website of the Year and why your editor really enjoyed that really accessible article. It could otherwise be quite complex.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you, Georgie.
You're more than welcome. Check us in the post.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Making the pound in your pocket
go that little bit further.
Now, the banking crisis, we've spoken about that, haven't we? Caused by all sorts of havoc. Greedy bankers, greedy banks pillaging the nation's wealth. Enough. Competition was what was needed in the financial sector, and so in rode the white knights of challenger banks. A raft of Best Buy saving deals are being offered as well at the moment. 60, in fact, of the best rates in Britain are from the new small banks that have had a banking licence for a year.
Metro Bank is not meant to be a bank. It's about reinventing how the banking services are delivered.
TSB isn't like other big banks. That's because every penny TSB customers deposit stays right here in Britain.
We've listened hard to what our intermediaries want from Virgin Money.
That's why at Clydesdale Bank, when you need us most, we'll give you a named member of our team who'll be per...
At Yorkshire Bank, we've been providing a warm welcome to customers for over 150 years. That's why.
Oh, so soothing, aren't they? But before you jump in, you might want to pause. A new chart reveals how new challenger banks are luring in savers with Best Buy deals, only to rein them in once they're established. Well, I spoke to Harrison Kelly from Challenger Bank TSB about this.
Most people don't come to a challenger bank because of rates. They come because of service. They come because of a new approach to banking. They come because they're just fed up with their old bank and they're, you know, not feeling like they're getting rewarded in any way. So that's what we've seen. And over the past, you know, so TSB came back onto the high street in September 2013. And over the past year, we've seen 1,000 customers a day flocking to the bank. Mm. And, you know, some of them will come for our, you know, rates. You know, we offer 5% on our current account. But a lot of them will come for our new approach to banking and our new style and attitude, which I think you wouldn't get with lots of other banks.
Yeah, but people still want good rates. And they want those rates to last. They don't want to feel like they've just shifted over. They only to feel that they've had the rug pulled from beneath them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, our rates are very competitive, actually. And
yeah, how are you mentioned in here?
Yeah, so our e-savings has, 1.1%, which is quite a respectable rate. 1.4 on our two-year fixed-term ISA. Mm. And of course, you know, when we launched, the rate might have been slightly different. We've got to remember that this conversation is happening in a very low interest environment. You know, the Bank of England base rate has been at 0.5% since 2009. So therefore, to offer, you know, rates much, much higher than that is difficult. But what TSB does offer, and I think what we've seen a shift in the market, is people are starting to use their current accounts for their savings.
Well, that was Harrison Kelly there from Challenger Bank TSB. Rachel, tell us a little bit more about this. Customers want good service. That's why they're going, is it?
Yeah, whatever. It's a really good graph. I'd go have a look at it. And it sort of just says it all. It's quite damning, really. The longer a challenger bank has had a license, the lower their rates are likely to be. This is not surprising. They want to, when they launched, you can't have a bank that doesn't have any money to lend out, so they've got to get some in. How do you get it in? You go to the top of the Best Buy's tables, look attractive to customers and bring in the money. When you've got as much as you want, there's no reason to retain those rates anymore, so they fall again. This is not something that is unique to challenger banks.
No.
Any bank will only have rates as high as they need to get the money that they want, or as high as they think that they'll need to be able to retain you. Unfortunately, because people seem so hesitant to switch banks, we're used to high street banks having lower rates because they don't need to have high rates to keep you. You just stay there by default anyway. So it's not surprising, but it's kind of nice to have it laid bare on such a simple chart like that.
So who are we talking about? What sorts of banks here?
Ah, what are the big names? We've seen lots in recent times. The big ones, TSB, of course, Challenger, but also it's already got quite a name. Virgin Money, Metro Bank, Clydesdale and Yorkshire Bank. And then we see smaller ones as well on the top of the Best Buy tables. We've got these fancy new ones, the online-only Atom Bank, and Ikano is also having a bit of a push at the moment as well. So the message, as always, you just have to keep switching. That's the only way to make sure that you're getting the rates that, the highest rates that you can on your accounts. Or go for one of these mega current accounts. That seems to be what people are doing, which often end up paying better rates than the savings accounts. Interesting, actually, the interview just now mentioned, well, we have to remember that we are in a low rates environment. Mm. We've got Bank of England has been a base rate of 0.5%. 5%, but it's been there since 2009, March. That's a long time. Rates have been falling since then. They have never been lower. So the argument sort of doesn't make so much sense to me when they continue to fall despite the base rate being so low for so long.
Saying that about the dropping rates and the like, I want to know, firstly, do they compare in the market? They're still better than the big banks. And as Rachel pointed out, they're not alone. The big banks are also doing this as well, Simon. And more generally, the picture, as Harrison Kelly from TSB was saying a little bit earlier, people do want better service, and more competition does mean we have more places to switch to.
It does, yes, and I'm all up for more competition in the banking sector, and I'm all up for challenger banks, and I'm delighted that we have seen so many of them come onto the scene. However, the ones that I really like are the small new banks coming onto the scene. When I look at banks like TSB and Yorkshire and Clydesdale, I'm sorry to TSB, Yorkshire and Clydesdale, but I do not class you as challenger banks. TSB has been around for donkey's years. It was part of Lloyds. It's now been bought. It's now part of a Spanish group. You know, to my mind, that's not a challenger bank.
That's a good point. What is? Okay, is the official definition?
Well, no, there isn't. So it's you know, it's these new banks. Again, Virgin. You know, is Virgin a challenger bank? Virgin's basically Northern Rock with a rebrand. You know, that's not a challenger bank to my mind. I think that you're looking at people, you know, we've got Atom Bank is one of the names that comes out. We've got people like Aldermore, Shawbrook, people like that, those smaller banks, even Metro. I mean, Metro is a new bank over here. So I think that those are more challenger banks. And in fact, I'd probably say maybe Tesco is more of a challenger bank to my mind because it is effectively a relatively new bank. And I think that actually most people have joined Lloyds because they've signed up to its current account that pays 5% interest. I don't think that they've joined, not Lloyds, sorry. There you go. Freudian slip there.
Point
I proof. Think most people have joined TSB because of its current account that pays 5% interest. And that is not meant as a criticism of TSB because it's got a current account that's paying people 5% interest, which is great for them.
Now, Simon, we've held out for as long as we can, but it is that time. Yes, rev up the engine. The team have taken ownership for a week of a rather nice-looking sports car, actually. £35,000. Is this the best value sports car around this year? But before you get too excited, a perennial British disappointment, the American muscle car. So can Ford's first right-hand drive Mustang be the hit of the year? Firstly, Simon, what's an American muscle car?
Oh, well, the Americans, you know, they don't build sports cars like the Europeans. They tend to be bigger, more powerful, not quite so nimble, colossal engines because petrol is dirt cheap in America. So this Ford Mustang, the Ford Mustang dates back to the late 60s, and it's an iconic car, and there's been a number of variations of it. The most famous, you know, original version, as driven by Steve McQueen, is the one that's celebrated. And then over the years, they've kind of been a bit hit and miss. But this new one is not only very good, it's a pretty good looking car, but it's also available in the UK officially in right-hand drive for the first time. And it costs just £35,000, which is a lot of money.
Compare that in the market, like
in comparison to other cars, you know, that it's going up against. So, for example, it will hit 60 in less than 5 seconds. A BMW M4 would cost you twice as much, you know, that will do the same. And so we had one on test for a week, and I must admit, they stand out. They stick at you. I did, yeah. We had one on test. I was drove it around for a bit. Rob Hull, our motion reporter, was driving it as well. We took it out and filmed a test video as well. It was great fun to drive. It was absolutely brilliant fun to drive. It's not the sort of most modern or refined of cars, or the most luxurious. It's got this thumping great 5-litre V8 engine that makes this wonderful noise, has absolutely hideous fuel economy. I was getting 14 miles to the gallon driving around London in it. But boy, does it put a smile on your face, and boy, do people love it. People stop you, they ask you about it, they talk about it. And that story has sold like hotcakes on This Is Money this week. Readers have been absolutely lapping it up.
Why? Why are they so interested in it?
Oh, because it's unusual and it's iconic and it looks great and it's this thumping, great, big, old... It's a throwback to another era. This is the brand new Mustang, but it really is a throwback to another era. People aren't going to keep making cars like this, you know, forever. I reckon in 5 years' time, you're going to be hard-pushed to find many new cars like this. And it does, when you compare it to the cost of many other cars, represent a comparative bargain.
But the real test, though, is, Rachel, I'm holding up the picture. How excited are you by this car?
Why did you cut to me, Georgie? Thing is, in the States, petrol's a lot cheaper, isn't it? I mean, that's so it makes more sense there. But if you've got something that gazzles Gus...
Mm. Yeah, either way.
Whatever, it's Friday. Then who cares if it's a lot cheaper? It's
yeah, but look at it.
Fortune.
Look at it, though. Simon just described this as a thing of beauty, no?
Get me a bus.
There you go. Personal finance editor Rachel Rickard Strauss, editor Simon Lambert, thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.